In the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, determined that 100,000 African elephants have been killed by poachers in the last 3 years. The worst slaughter has taken place in Central Africa. The animals are killed because of the growing demand for illegal ivory, mostly in Southeast Asia. The photos of dead elephant carcasses, their faces hacked apart to remove their tusks, are horrifying. Today we want to talk about efforts to save elephants and some new research being done to understand their intelligence and their social smarts. We have two guests, including Josh Plotnick. He's a lecturer in conservation biology at Mahidol University in Thailand, the CEO of U.S. nonprofit called Think Elephants International, also head of research at the Golden Triangle Asian Elephant Foundation in Thailand. He joins us from Thailand. And Josh Plotnick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is George Whittemeyer, chair of the scientific board of the Kenya-based nonprofit Save the Elephants. He's also professor in the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology at Colorado State University, the lead author of that report that I quoted. He also studies elephants in Kenya's Samburu National Reserve. And George Whittemeyer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
In fact, George, let me begin with you and begin with this survey, the study that you did in parts of Africa. And I ask, you know, what explains the increase in poaching? Because I know that elephants were staging a comeback after being decimated in many ways in the 1970s and the 1980s. What explains this increase in poaching?
Yes, that's very true. We went through a really rough period in the 70s and 80s and had a relative hiatus for the two decades following the 1989 ban in ivory. And unfortunately, we've seen a massive uptick in the level of killing very recently, sort of starting about 5 years ago in a lot of protected areas and preceding that a bit earlier in less protected areas. And the drivers of it are pretty elementary. It's consumption for ivory. It's people using ivory for art investment, trinkets, presents, whatnot, and there's been a massive increase in the consumption of this, particularly in East Asia, as you mentioned, and with that, up goes the black market price of ivory. The greater use of ivory, the greater the value, and as black market prices have increased in Africa, a lot of criminal syndicates have found this to be a viable option, a viable product in which to trade and do commerce. And so the result has been a massive increase in the level of poaching, a massive increase in the level of trafficking of ivory, and the result is a lot of large-scale killing of elephants, unfortunately.
Josh, are you seeing something similar in Asia? You're in Thailand, but are Asian elephants also under threat?
Absolutely, they are. The threats to Asian elephants are a bit different than the threats to African elephants, as Professor Whittemeyer can certainly confirm for you. The issue with African elephants is that usually both female and male elephants have tusks, so the poachers can go after both sexes, whereas in Asia, typically it's only the males that have tusks and not all of them. And so there hasn't been much poaching for tusks in Asia. The biggest problem facing the Asian elephants, and the total number on the Asian continent, we believe, is between 35 and 50,000, and we don't actually know what that number really is. The biggest issue facing these elephants is what we call human-elephant conflict. So, pretty simply, there's not a lot of habitat for these elephants, and they're raiding crops, they're killing people, people are retaliating against the elephants by killing the elephants, and so we're losing elephants in pretty large numbers simply because they don't have a place to live.
Going back to you, George Whittemeyer, and I have to say, you know, your study, it really is just sort of horrifying to think about these elephants being killed, especially killed in such what appears to be such horrible ways. You talk about criminal syndicates. Are we talking about bows and arrows? Are we talking about assault rifles? I think we need to know how this works.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a number of ways to kill elephants. And in the area I work, it's primarily assault rifles. A lot of militias are involved in killing, and most of that is using military-grade weapons, particularly assault rifles. And we're seeing that really across Central and East Africa. And in other places, I guess the problem with assault rifles is they make a lot of noise, and that can draw attention. And so in places where you're likely to, by shooting elephants, you're likely to garner a response. People have switched to a more silent method, such as occasionally bows and arrows. That's less used, but poison bows and arrows are used, and unfortunately, people are now relying on poisoning. There is an interesting piece in New York Times about the ramifications of this for the greater ecology of the systems. They're poisoning fruit and putting it out for elephants, and in a couple cases we've had where they actually poisoned a water hole in a very arid environment where all animals are reliant on that water source. They're targeting elephants, but they ended up killing basically everything in the system.
Is it possible, though, to get the ivory from the tusks without killing an elephant? Is that possible?
It is possible. We've done this preventatively, actually, for a couple of reasons. One, Josh mentioned, we have human-elephant conflict issues with African elephants as well, and a lot of times they use electric fencing, and they can short those fences out with their tusks. So their tusks have been removed for that reason. We can remove the tusks. It's a tooth modified incisor. It has a very deep root that goes up into the skull, and to actually remove the entire tusk, you'd have to do a root canal, which is not really feasible in the field. You can cut off the leading edge of the tusk, but that leaves quite a bit of ivory left where the root is. So you obviously can't, without doing a root canal, you don't want to cut the tooth into the root cavity. And it's just prohibitive to do that. It's quite expensive to put an elephant down. It's to cut off the non-vasculated part of the tooth actually still leaves a significant chunk of ivory that we think would probably still elicit killing. And so it's not a very viable option.
Josh, let me turn to you. And both of you have done research on the kind of social intelligence that elephants have. And I'm just wondering, if we're talking about herds being decimated in many ways, what is the impact on, I guess, the social hierarchy, or even, dare I say, the kind of emotional life of these elephants?
I would say it's pretty dramatic. I think that, you know, a lot of this has come from, a lot of our understanding of the emotional intelligence of these animals has come primarily from anecdotal evidence over the last 50 years, and then going back more than 100 years in some cases. And what we see, because these animals live in very closely related, consistent family groups, where the matriarch, usually the oldest female with the most experience, leads the family group, and the females remain in the herd for their entire lives. It's the males that leave once they reach sexual maturity. They're very closely related. They take care of each other. They protect each other from potential predators or potential conflicts. You see coordinated helping in the wild, what we call targeted helping. So an individual, let's say a baby calf, falls into a mud pit and is unable to get out, other individuals will figure out a way to coordinate their behavior to retrieve the calf and rescue it from danger. And what we are probably starting to see, and there's some evidence of this in recent studies, is that when you remove certain individuals from the herd, be it these closely knit family groups of females where the matriarch might be killed, and therefore the younger individuals that have less experience are unable to, you know, find water holes or navigate difficult environments, or we might be looking at what we call bachelor herds, where a lot of the male elephants, the bulls, will form small groups where they move around together to protect each other and to, you know, find resources together. And if you remove some of the older bulls through poaching or some other mechanism, the younger bulls, it seems, may not know how to actually behave themselves. And so you've got instances of the elephants attacking each other or attacking other species. So I think there are pretty dramatic changes that are going on in terms of the family group dynamics and in terms of the emotional behavior of these animals, because as George and I are, and other scientists are finding, these are very intelligent animals. I would argue that in some ways they're similar to ourselves and to the great apes and dolphins and other species we consider to be very intelligent. And when we attack them and we kill family members in front of them, I think that you will see changes in their emotional state, and those changes will be very negative.
George, can you say that an elephant grieves the loss of a member of the family or the herd?
Yeah, one of the remarkable things about elephants is that they do appear to grieve. So this is there's been actually some discussion about this, and depending on who you speak to, it's arguable about which species actually show some sort of remorseful state when they interact with their dead. And it's been quite clear that humans do this. We know this very obviously. And another species, probably the other species that's been most clearly identified as displaying similar types of behavior have been elephants, and that when they lose individuals, we've seen them, a mother lose a calf and actually carry the calf's body around for a couple days as it, you know, essentially decomposes. Essentially, she's so traumatized, she's not willing to leave the carcass of her baby. We've seen numerous displays where there's an elephant dies and other elephants within its family and even social relations of it come up and do very odd behavior, such as standing over it, putting their foot over the head of the elephant without touching it, and sort of rotating their foot around the head, and doing all sorts of very odd, non-normal behaviors that you would see an elephant typically display in relation to the carcass. And we've also seen them protect carcasses of elephants and defend it against anybody coming up to it, as well as covering it with branches and things like this. So there's really interesting behaviors they do with their dead. It's very striking. It's seen all over the continent of Africa and in all different populations. It's a very common behavior, actually, and it's very unique in the animal kingdom. There's been some discussion, do great apes actually mourn their dead, and there's some debate about it. I think with elephants, I would say the only two species there is really not much debate about is elephants and humans.
And Josh, about a minute before we have to take our first break here, do elephants also use their trunk, I mean, in the sort of tactile way that George was just describing?
Absolutely. I think that you see, I recently, part of my dissertation research was on consolation, so the ability of elephants to console other individuals in distress, and usually the first contact we would see, physical contact, was trunk touching. So the elephants will take the tip of their trunk and either put it on the faces of another individual that's in distress, or we also saw them put their trunks inside the mouths of the other elephants. And we actually see this in chimpanzees as well, and it seems to be a sign of reassurance. Chimpanzees sometimes bite appendages off each other, obviously not a pleasant experience, but they do it sometimes in conflict. And when you put your finger in another individual's mouth, you're saying, hey, I'm vulnerable, which means I'm here to help you, not to hurt you. And I think that's possibly what we're seeing with the elephants. So a lot of the use of the trunk by the elephants, both in Africa and in Asia, is a way of sending a signal either of reassurance or some type of emotional connection.
Well, we are talking about elephants in this hour of Radio Times. The fact that they are under threat in Africa. Our guest, George Wittemeyer, part of a survey finding that in the last 3 years, an estimated 100,000 African elephants have been slaughtered. There is an illegal ivory trade, and much of this ivory ending up in Southeast Asia. Josh Plotnick joining us as well. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about, and also talk with you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
JPMorgan Chase and Stepping Stone Scholars, a Philadelphia nonprofit dedicated to preparing underserved students for academic success, support WHYY. The Step Into Fall Gala will be September 20th at the new Dilworth Park. For tickets, steppingstonescholars.org.
Next time on The Pulse, dinosaur-obsessed children have to learn a new name.
Dreadnoughtus.
Dreadnoughtus.
Is it real?
Very real and massive.
You're talking about a dozen big elephants smushed into one body, or 7 or 8 T-Rex smushed into one body.
Philadelphia scientists made this important find, which could be used as a template to understand other remains.
They really help us fill in those missing parts.
The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. When I say reggae, you might think of Jamaica, but a lot of reggae artists are from the U.S., including Florida's Sasha Dias.
So many questions asked, so many answers to see.
The new sounds of reggae next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Beck Institute for Cognitive Behavior Therapy supports WHYY and offers a research-based and compassionate treatment approach for clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. More information about the Beck Institute and CBT at beckinstitute.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, we are talking about elephants in this hour of Radio Times. Let me reintroduce our guest. Josh Plotnick is the CEO of a U.S. nonprofit called Think Elephants International, also head of research at the Golden Triangle Asian Elephant Foundation in Thailand. He is joining us from Thailand. Also with us is George Whittemeyer, chair of the scientific board of the Kenya-based nonprofit Save the Elephants. He's a professor in the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology at Colorado State University. He studies elephants in Kenya's Samburu National Reserve. Also the lead author of this new report we've been talking about, Illegal Killing of Ivory Drives Global Decline in African Elephants. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. George, part of this study found that there is a direct line between consumer demand in Southeast Asia, and it seems like largely from China, and the number of illegally killed elephants in Africa. Does it make sense? Which end of this pipeline is the best place to focus, at the Southeast Asia end, at the demand end, or at the supply end?
Well, we've been through this before, and we've had success at stopping this sort of consumption before. It really takes methods at both ends of the supply chain, including the middle part of the supply chain. And so demand reduction was the key to stopping the previous elephant carnage, large-scale illegal killing for ivory. That was driven primarily by Western nations in Japan in the 70s and 80s. Education campaigns, awareness campaigns were effective, particularly in the West, at turning attention and rejecting, sort of having a social rejection of the use of this product. So I think we need to replicate that. There's a number of groups doing excellent work in China now trying to replicate and catalyze a social shift in the perception of ivory. That's fundamental to this. The consumption is driving the price, which is driving the killing. In Africa, we're seeing a lot of places with success. We know what we need to do to have successful measures to protect elephants. The problem is it's quite expensive. Nations like Kenya, where I'm working, have mobilized a lot of their resources to protect elephants. They've increased their number of rangers. They've invested heavily in equipment, and they've deployed these people, and we're having effect. We're seeing poaching decline in the system I work in after enormous investment and effort. And I just want to highlight that this type of policing, this is actually costing human lives. So rangers are dying protecting elephants. So it's a very costly thing for these nations to protect their elephants because of the price of the ivory, because there's militias that are interested in trafficking ivory, using that to raise funds, because you have criminal syndicates that are very effective at trafficking drugs, weapons, other illicit goods. They now see ivory as a commodity they can also move to great profit. And so we have these very well-established, effective, very difficult to break up criminal groups that are messing around in this product and facilitating the killing. And so it's a global issue, it's a global problem, and it's really difficult to tackle. But we do know what it takes to succeed, and we know what it takes to succeed on the ground, and we know what it takes to succeed ultimately, which is to reduce the demand.
Josh, let me turn to you, and you're joining us from Thailand, and as we know, Southeast Asia is a market for ivory. Why is it seen as so valuable, so precious? I know that one can see all the things that are made out of it, and that it seems to have a kind of status symbol for some people as well, and perhaps even China, with this growing class of middle-class people and very wealthy people there. Does ivory have a certain cachet for them?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's pretty much the biggest problem. This dramatic increase in the size of the middle class in China, and the vision of ivory products as being a status symbol of luxury out of China is really driving this demand. The issue in Thailand is not necessarily the demand for ivory products within the country, but due to some loopholes within Thai law, which allows domestic elephants, elephants living in captivity in Thailand, to have their ivory cut and then sold within the country legally. Some of the ivory that's coming from Africa is going through countries like Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, but particularly in Thailand, the ivory comes through, it's processed here, it's carved here, and then it's sold on as if it originated in Thailand, which permits the illegal trade of the ivory from Africa through Thailand into China. I just wanted to highlight something that George said that I agree with wholeheartedly, and that's that we really have to tackle this issue from two fronts. One is anti-poaching efforts, the other is education. The problem that I have in Thailand is that we're trying to launch education programs, but there's a lack of funds for education. You've got large organizations like the Bill Clinton, Bill Chelsea Hillary Clinton Foundation based in New York, Leonardo DiCaprio, the famous actor, who have raised tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars for anti-poaching efforts. But there isn't that much money, relatively speaking, going into education. And I think the biggest problem that I feel that we might face is that if we put all this money into anti-poaching, and as George's research is showing, we're losing 100,000 elephants every 3 years, that means we're going to lose these animals in 20 years. And let's say we spend all this money and we lose the elephant. What are we going to have to show for it if we put all that money into anti-poaching efforts? I think we need to be able to say that if we're going to lose this animal, and I don't think it's inevitable, I hope it's not, but if we lose this animal in 20 years, I want to be able to say, well, you know what, at least we put money into educating the next generation of both Western students and kids in China and Southeast Asia to understand the importance of these animals and their other natural resources and endangered species so that they can be the next generation of you know, world changers.
George, let me put something else on the table, and I know this is probably a controversy among elephant researchers, but I was reading an article, it looks like it's in National Geographic, that some are saying, look, let's have some limited trade when it comes to ivory, perhaps even using the ivory from elephants who have died from natural causes, that might take care of some of this demand, especially if it looks like the ban has not been as effective as people had hoped.
Right. There's a lot of debate about this, and there has been for several decades. And I guess what we saw is we had limited trade. In 2002, there was a one-off sale to Japan, and in 2008, there was a one-off sale to China and Japan. And the result of that one-off sale was that there was a legal ivory product from African elephants in China that was being legally sold from basically late 2008 on. And what we saw is quite shortly after that period when this legal ivory started coming onto the market from this one-off sale, a lot of illegal ivory started flowing into China. A lot of illegal killing started exponentially increasing in Africa. And essentially that legal market in China is acting as a means to liquidate illegal ivory. So there's no distinction. There supposedly is distinction, but in de facto on the ground, illegal ivory is being sold, laundered through the legal ivory markets in China, and that's facilitating this killing. So the current legal, the one-off framework appears to have really failed in terms of its conservation objectives. The big thing on using any product commercially, I guess in general we know commercial trade in a wildlife product can be really dangerous. It's driven by demand, nuances in demand. If demand skyrockets for some reason, which it clearly is for ivory at the moment, it can inundate the natural supply, and that's where we are right now. The demand is exceeding the natural supply of ivory through natural death or other means, as you mentioned, and we simply cannot supply the enough product to these markets, and the result is the species is declining.
And that's George Whittemeyer, who joins us along with Josh Plotnick. We are talking about elephants during this hour of Radio Times. George Whittemeyer, the lead author of a new report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, finding that in the last 3 years, 100,000 African elephants have been killed by poachers. Josh Plotnick is head of research at the Golden Triangle Asian Elephant Foundation, and that is in Thailand. And we are talking about efforts to protect elephants, elephant intelligence as well, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. George, let me just go back to you. Something that Josh said sort of sparked a question for me. Trying to imagine a world without elephants, and we don't have elephants roaming the United States. But if we're talking about 100,000 elephants being killed over a three-year period, if that were to continue, how soon would we lose African elephants, and what would it mean to the world not to have elephants, or African elephants, certainly?
Well, so I'll start off by saying I don't think we're going to lose African elephants. And one of the things that I think is really important in sort of these dark moments of a conservation crisis is that we have recipes for success. Right now in Africa, 75% of the populations of elephants are declining, and that's completely unacceptable. But the converse is that we have 25% that are stable and increasing. And those populations are being protected effectively. There's appropriate intelligent networks that are allowing disruption of poaching syndicates. And we know how to have successful conservation. We merely need to replicate this and increase the scale at which we're doing it. So I'm confident that the species is going to be okay. The cost is going to be that we're going to lose a lot of populations of elephants, perhaps a significant portion, half of them are really in threat right now, and that's unacceptable for those systems. The reality is these elephants are critical parts of their ecosystems. They are a primary seed disperser. We call them an ecological engineer. They engineer the natural systems. They balance the sort of grass woodland balance and savanna systems. When you remove elephants, what you have is encroachment of the bush. This is a huge issue with livestock people, especially because that obviously they lose their grazing lands. They're the primary seed disperser, as I mentioned, in the second largest carbon sequestering forest on the planet. So they're a key part of the carbon flux globally. They're also, we've mentioned some of the cognitive value of them, and I just wanted to repeat that we've lost 100,000 elephants in a three-year period, and that's not including the actual cost to the elephant social system, these elephant populations. We're removing the primary breeding males, the matriarchs of family groups, the mothers of offspring, and we're leaving behind a highly disrupted system with orphaned elephants, and they're trying to rebuild their lives. They are resilient. They are rebuilding their lives, but we're removing this knowledge base that's really critical for them to function, their systems. So there's that cost. And then I guess the last cost is the economic cost to the African nations that have elephants. Elephants are a massive tourist attraction. Tourism revenue tends to be a primary means of international exchange and in bringing international dollars into a lot of these countries. And in particular, a lot of those dollars go into rural areas that don't have a lot of other means, a lot of other economic activities. So it's really it's having a huge impact on the local economies of some very impoverished places as well. So there's just multiple impacts of this decimation.
Josh, I'm going to make a sort of jarring right turn here, but I know both of you, but I know you've been doing some really fascinating research with elephants and their and their ability to problem solve. There's some research where they're pulling on, if they work together, I guess to coordinate their behavior, they can get some food by pulling on two ends of a rope. Help us understand their this kind of intelligence, because problem solving is a high level intelligence, it seems to me.
What's pretty remarkable about the elephants, and we'll just group Asian and African elephants together just for the sake of discussion, because they are very similar, at least in terms of their cognitive abilities, is that remarkably, we all accept that the elephant is one of the smartest animals on the planet, but there's actually very little, relatively speaking, in terms of what we've done on humans or chimpanzees, for instance, empirical evidence of this intelligence, which means setting up controlled experiments, which is more difficult in the wild, easier in captivity. I work with a group of 26 elephants in the Golden Triangle in northern Thailand, and we set up experiments to specifically look at how these animals think about their physical, which is normally physical problem solving, navigation, finding food, and social cognition, which is how they think about their social relationships. So over the last 10 years, our group has done studies looking at mirror self-recognition, which is simply when you look in the mirror, do you recognize yourself? Do you see that individual staring back at you as a mirror reflection of yourself. A pretty simple test, but actually one that very few species in the animal kingdom pass. The only species to date that have passed this test are obviously humans, and human children pass this test at around 18 to 24 months. The great apes, which are chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, orangs, dolphins, one species of corvid, which is the crow family, which are considered to be among the most intelligent bird species, and an experiment we ran on the Asian elephant. What's interesting about this group of species is not necessarily that they recognize themselves in the mirror, but that they tend to be considered among the cognitive elite in the animal kingdom, that they're able to show empathy. And interestingly, children begin to show empathy at about the same time that they start to show mirror self-recognition, so we think that the two are linked, but also complex cooperation. So the experiment that you described, pretty simply, it was kind of like a pulley system. It's based on a study done on chimpanzees almost 100 years ago, where two chimpanzees had to pull two ropes attached to a very heavy box, and if they didn't coordinate their pulling, the box wouldn't move towards them. Obviously, we don't give elephants a huge table that weighs thousands of pounds. That would be ridiculous. But we came up with a design that we adapted from a Japanese experiment where a single rope is thread through and around a table in a way that it's kind of like a pulley system, that if one end of the rope is pulled without the other, it becomes unthreaded. And the elephants learned not only that they needed to pull the rope together, but if one elephant arrived at the rope before their partner, they had to wait. So they had to actually understand that partnership was needed for success. And this matches very well with what we know of wild elephant behavior, that, as I described earlier and George was mentioning as well, these animals take very careful attention to other individuals within their family group. Some of the research that we're doing now is actually focused on sensory perception. We're very interested in looking at how elephants use their olfactory sense, their sense of smell, because it seems that in general, in the ways in which they navigate their physical and social worlds, they're not using their vision, certainly not in Asian elephants, as much as they're using their sense of smell and their sense of hearing, primarily their sense of hearing in terms of their social communication, so communicating with others. But we think, and some of our recent research seems to show, that they're using their sense of smell to navigate their physical world. And there are two reasons why this is important. One is we want to be able to test these animals in what we call an ecologically valid situation. We want to be able to show that elephants are intelligent, but we can't simply give them experiments that we've done on humans or chimpanzees because they're a completely different species that, quote-unquote, see their world differently. So we want to be able to fairly compare these species across taxa. But I think more importantly, from a conservation perspective, is one of the biggest problems facing elephants in Asia in terms of human-elephant conflict is the fact that we just don't know that much about how animals like elephants live within their natural world. I mean, in particular, in terms of the elephants, why they're raiding crops, why they're encroaching on farmland. Yes, we can say that they're losing habitat, but potentially it has a lot to do with how their senses interact with their environment. And we believe that the more we can understand about how elephants smell, see, or hear their world, the better equipped we're going to be able to be to put ourselves in their shoes and protect them.
Well, we are talking about elephants in this hour of Radio Times. That's Josh Plotnick. He's CEO of a U.S. nonprofit called Think Elephants International, also head of research at the Golden Triangle Asian Elephant Foundation in Thailand, joining us from Thailand. Also with us, George Wittemeyer. He studies elephants in Kenya's Samburu National Reserve. He's also chairman of the scientific board of the Kenya-based nonprofit Save the Elephants, and he's a professor at Colorado State University. We're going to take a very short break and then get some callers in as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with available active noise control that reduces unwanted cabin noise to help provide a more pleasant driving experience. More at Lincoln.com.
The two journalists beheaded by ISIS were dressed in orange, like the jumpsuits some detainees in Gitmo are required to wear. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times reporter Charlie Savage, who has reported extensively about Gitmo and was there in August. This week, he reported on how Gitmo is decaying and why it's been so difficult to close. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Vietnam's so-called peace with honor unraveled in 1975.
Another dozen are running along, grabbing at the air stair. There's a sea of humanity jamming on.
filmmaker Rory Kennedy, director and producer of The Last Days in Vietnam, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
PNC Arts Alive and the Brandywine River Museum of Art in Chatsford support WHYY and present First Sunday's family programs, pirate treasure hunts, artistic animal adventures, and other family events held monthly on the first Sunday. More at brandywine.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with George Whittemeyer and Josh Plotnick about elephants. Let me get, looks like Matthew from Trenton to join our conversation. And Matthew, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was wondering if a material existed that is indistinguishable or close to indistinguishable from ivory that could be used to make a bunch of products, and then you could flood the market with those products and would drive down the prices and reduce the cachet of ivory in general.
George Whittemeyer, you want to take that?
Yeah, it turns out it's quite difficult to produce, and there's been some discussions about 3D printing of ivory or some sort of things, but the way it grows, it has these quite complex Schwager lines, that they're integrated lines that give it this incredible quality for carving. There is mammoth ivory that's come into the market in a huge way in China particularly, and that's coming out of global warming is melting ice sheets, and a lot of buried ivory in Siberia is coming into the market. And so the thought was that this sort of large volume of mammoth ivory might help inundate that market. But in fact, it looks like the importation and the consumption of mammoth ivory is very parallel to that of African ivory. And it's just both showing massive growth.
We also have a caller. It looks like she couldn't stay on. This is to you, Josh. Martha wondering if recent research on trauma could be applied to elephants given their advanced social dynamics in terms of, I guess, the kind of loss, traumatic loss that we've been talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. There is some evidence, and this is in my area, so I don't know that much about it, but there's a potential for investigating things like PTSD, which obviously is a huge issue now in the States and other countries where there is war and other conflict, and soldiers returning home with emotional situations that they need to get treatment for. And I think what we're seeing in terms of what's happening with the elephants in Africa and in Asia, as George was saying, the disruption of these family groups indicates that there is certainly an area of research that could be exploited in looking at how traumatic these situations are for these animals and potentially what we can do to mitigate these problems. Obviously, it's catastrophic. I mean, we can't go into the field and unleash a group of psychologists to talk to these elephants, unfortunately. So what we really have to try to do is to protect what's left of the family groups and try to ensure that these individual wild elephants get as best a social family group dynamic, as great a social relationship with other individuals as they possibly can.
George, you mentioned some orphan elephants, and I've seen videos of orphan elephants, and can they be sort of brought into, in a sense, be adopted by another family of elephants?
Yeah, so we're studying some of the orphans in Samburu right now. My graduate student Schiffer Goldenberg is leading that study, and I think it's important to highlight when we talk about post-traumatic stress syndrome or other things that we've diagnosed for human brains that elephants, the lineage of elephants split off from our lineage 60 million years ago, and so the fact that we're dealing with these two extremely differentiated species that both show incredibly complex cognitive abilities doesn't necessarily mean that the psychological mechanisms are identical. And as Josh mentioned, it's pretty difficult to apply what we know about human minds to try to rehabilitate elephants or something of that nature. But indeed, on their own, they're able to do remarkable things and take care of each other in remarkable ways. And so we're looking at how the orphans of devastated families are recuperating and recovering their lives. And they form novel bonds with novel individuals, not necessarily genetic relatives, but still they can form very tight, integrated social networks with other orphans orphans or other individuals, families, integration into a family where they're not genetically related, but they become part of that family. And so they're able to rebuild their lives, their social lives, and their normal social situation, which clearly is critical to their survival. And so they are able to do this on their own. And what it takes is, as Josh mentioned, is giving them safety.
Safety, which I guess in at Sumburu National Reserve, they have that kind of safety in other reserves?
We're working on it. They do. We've come a long way over the last 3 to 4 years. From our peak was in 2011, where we were hemorrhaging. It was a really bad situation on the ground, and with a consolidated effort, a lot of investment, a lot of effective collaboration, we're starting to see control of the poaching levels up there, and especially in the protected areas, the elephants are doing quite well. We do have sporadic poaching still emerge. It's not over. Again, I mentioned the price of ivory, the black market price of ivory is so high that it becomes a temptation for anybody who's sort of involved in criminal activity in the area to turn to killing elephants because it's so viable. So the pressure hasn't gone away, but we're seeing a lot of success, and we're holding the line, and that's what it takes for these elephants to rebuild what's been taken from them.
And that's good to know. Let me get Diane from Glenside to join our conversation. Hi, Diane. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. My question is, or comment, there's so much caches that some of these African countries have of the elephant ivories, the tusks, and they just burned and crushed a whole lot of them, I know, in protest over this. But wouldn't it be more beneficial to sell these stocks off for protection of the elephants rather than destroying it? It's just such a sin to see those being crushed.
Well, Diane, I appreciate the call. And George, I'm going to go back to you. And we touched on this earlier, whether there's a sort of a legal way to meet some of this demand. And I think Diane is speaking to that. And I think we've all seen, or a lot of us have seen, those images of tusks being burned.
Right. So the U.S. Crushed their ivory recently. That was illegally traded ivory that was confiscated. And as all confiscated goods, it's the same mechanisms used for drugs or weapons or whatever. Those goods cannot be re-entered into the market. So they're typically destroyed with other products. That's been a classic judicial process. There has been a lot of debate about crushing and burning and can't we use that resource for demand reduction? And what we know, obviously there's legal issues with that. If we allow countries to confiscate and then sell ivory, there becomes an incentive for them to start playing in that legal market. So we want to avoid that. And also what's quite clear at the moment, and what I mentioned before, is that we just do not have enough natural ivory production to meet demand. And it doesn't matter what we do. The amount being crushed and burned is appears to be really drops in the bucket in terms of what's being consumed. It's just not going to have an impact on this market, unfortunately.
Josh, let me go back to you. And I'm interested in both of yours research when it comes to elephants. What are the main sort of challenges trying to figure out elephant intelligence or their social intelligence, their problem-solving abilities?
There are many challenges. The first is probably universal for anyone studying animal cognition, and that's you can't simply ask an animal a question. When you're testing children, and I'm not saying this is easy, but when you're testing children in developmental psychology studies, typically you give the child a set of instructions. So I'm going to give you this, and then I'm going to give you a choice, and I want you to make a choice based on, you know, these particular parameters. We can't do that with animals. So typically we have to go through very long and tedious training procedures, and this could be thousands of trials over many, many days, if not months, just till we get to the point where we can start to ask the animal particular questions. Because what we're trying to do is interpret their behavior in such a way that we can draw conclusions about their intelligence. When it comes to working with elephants, and I'm sure George can confirm this as well, when you're working with very intelligent animals, I'd say that the more intelligent the animal is, the more difficult it can be to work with them. In captivity in Thailand, for instance, because we work with captive animals, and we only work with animals that are well taken care of and well protected. You're also working with the elephant's handlers, and in Asia they're called mahouts. These guys that have, some of them grown up with these elephants, work with them almost 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And so you're not only testing the intelligence of the elephant, but you're dealing with the patience or lack of patience of the mahouts. You're also working with a 5 to 7 ton animal, even more in the African elephants. And these animals are very large, very intelligent, and very dangerous. So at our facility in Thailand, for instance, we built a rather large facility where the elephants could approach our research team, and we could interact with the elephants in terms of the experiments, but we were protected, typically called protected contact, so that we can interact with the elephants, but the elephants can't lash out at us. Throughout the day, they're in free contact, so we interact with them, but the first rule for all of our research team is be careful. This is a very intelligent, very dangerous animal, and unfortunately, they can kill people, and so we have to be very careful around them, and I think that, unfortunately, it tends to be one of our biggest challenges when we're testing intelligence.
George, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would just mention that I guess we're working in a wild setting, so we're dealing with quite a few other constraints in trying to study elephant cognitive abilities. One of the neat things that we're finding with understanding wild animals in general and how they perceive their environment and their relations with others is through remote data collection through tracking devices. And we're starting to be able to explore the decision-making process an elephant, an animal takes by actually looking at how they're moving in relation to different factors in the environment. And so we have to sort of create novel means to get insight into the cognitive process going on, because as Josh mentioned, it, we can't simply ask them. In the wild setting with elephants, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to do much experimental work. And so we're trying to find new ways to explore this really intricate and complex animal that we share the planet with, and it takes a lot of creative thinking.
Let me get Corrine from Conshohocken to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Corrine, go ahead, you're on the air. Do we have you? Looks like we don't, but Corrine says, I bought an antique ivory necklace many years ago. Should I not wear it? What statement does it make? I want to add to that also an email from Karen, who says that ivory bands are a real problem for musicians since many instruments, especially antique ones, have ivory on them. People are struggling, George and Josh, about what to do about the ivory that they may have in their possession. Do you have any suggestions, Josh?
It's a very difficult issue, and I know that there are many states within the United States that are grappling with this issue in terms of whether or not they ban ivory entirely or whether they try and focus their attention on the importation of illegal ivory, whether they grandfather clause in ivory products that are old or antiques or have been in people's possessions for a long time. I have a friend who's a violinist who's raised that exact same issue with me, you know, saying, this is going to really hurt musicians. I think it's a very difficult issue, but as George has been saying, this is an incredible animal that if we do not really make dramatic, drastic changes, we may lose. I really believe that, and I think that there's a good chance we could lose them in Asia before we would lose them in Africa. I think that my personal opinion is we need to be pretty dramatic in the changes we make, and I think that might mean a total ban on ivory products. That might not be necessarily realistic, so we might have to come up to some sort of diplomatic agreement on how to deal with that, and I think that diplomacy is always the way. Certainly it's how we deal with issues in Thailand and how we try to change values and try to influence the local population to think differently about these animals, but it's a real problem, and it's a very complex one.
George, you want to add to that? We're about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye.
Yeah, I would just like to add that I think, you know, both Josh and I are advocates for elephants, an advocate being speaking out for someone who can't speak for themselves. And in relation to elephants, the use of their teeth is killing them. It's causing massive destruction to these individuals' lives, and for that, using this product is actually very negative to them. We talk a lot about Chinese consumption. all major cities in the world, including in the U.S., are major consumers of ivory. We have illegal ivory being sold in the U.S., and it's a problem. Musicians have brought this up, as well as gun traders. NRA has got involved in this, been vocally opposed to the ban, and the reality is that the global world needs to recognize the use of this product is unacceptable. There are alternatives that can be used. I know a lot of people in the music world love ivory because of its resonance. Its structure is excellent for musical instrument. Mammoth ivory is a viable product that can be used in place of elephant ivory. It's probably not... The problem is it can be still used to cover up illegal ivory trade. But I think the musician in the weapons, the gun lobby, needs to look for viable options. I'd like them to drive some of that. And I'd like all of us to come on board and recognize that the use of this product is killing one of the world's most spectacular species.
Well, we have to end on that note. My thanks to you, Georgia Whittemeyer, and to you, Josh Plotnick, for joining us in this hour of Radio Times talking about elephants.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us. And Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Emily Hawes helping us out. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we want to close things out with The Elephant from Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals. It's performed by Yo-Yo Ma and the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Eugene Ormandy.